Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, the lovely and very talented Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. Going well. Another week has come and gone, or I guess maybe I'm coming off as a glass half empty kind of guy. We could be looking as though a new week is just beginning, Tim.
Yeah.
And as we head into a new week, lots of exciting things going on, and I can't wait. I got to be honest, Tim. I can't wait for people to see this season of The Holzer Files. We have been to some of the most insanely active places. We've had some great experiences, and I just found out where we're going to shoot our season finale, and I'll have to tell you about it off air, Tim.
Okay.
I wish I could tease it out right now, but they get very cross when I do that.
Oh.
But all I can do is just straight up tease and say, I'm so excited to get to go to this location and get to do what we do. So it's going to be a fun ride. I'm looking forward to a lot. But this season, I have seen and experienced things that have blown me away. And, you know, that's the beautiful thing about the field of the supernatural and the paranormal. Just when you start getting complacent, just when EVPs of Get Out or Evil Laughter stop feeling amazing,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
Which is so weird. You think, how is that possible? How do you record a disembodied voice and it starts to become mundane?
No, I can see it. Yeah. Right?
You can only hear Get Out so many times or on a recorder before it just becomes, you know, part of your ritual.
Right.
When we start getting weirder stuff and unbelievable experiences, it really reinvigorates. And I think that's why people continue to have such a great time with this field and love shows like ours and the different TV shows and the radio shows. And because there's always some new element that gets infused. And I'm very proud of the work we do on this show and on the Holzer Files. So I'm glad, you know, we're getting closer to that 15-year mark, Tim.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Coming up this January, 15 years we'll be together doing the show. I'm always surprised when you can say, wow, what more is there to talk about? But part of the reason for that success and the excitement is because of people like our guest coming up. Colin Dickey's back with us. His new book, The Unidentified, Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained, comes out July 21st, 2020. So it's out and available. As a matter of fact, we have a link for that in today's program. So make sure you go in and you purchase the book, rate and review the book, get it out there. Colin Dickey is a writer, speaker, and academic, and he's made a career out of collecting unusual objects and hidden histories all over the country. He's a regular contributor to the LA Review of Books and Lapham's Quarterly, and is the co-editor of the Morbid Anatomy Anthology. He is also a member of the Order of the Good Death, a collective of artists, writers, and death industry professionals interested in improving the Western world's relationship with mortality. He has a PhD in comparative literature from the University of Southern California. He is an associate professor of creative writing at National University. So obviously this man has much better things to do than show up on our show, but we got him anyway, Tim.
Great.
We got him anyway. Thank you so much for joining us again, Colin. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much. There's nowhere I'd rather be, honestly.
Oh, that's sweet to hear. I appreciate that.
You know. No, I'm kidding.
That's right. As far as right now, at this particular moment, there's no other place. And, you know, I know we had you on, gosh, was it already like 2 or 3 years ago?
I think it was 3 years ago. I think it was 2017.
Yeah, boy, that goes by fast, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Goes by fast. Well, you're the new book, The Unidentified, Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained. You know, kind of walk me through doing research for a book like this and going through there. I'd kind of like to tackle it in reverse, if you don't mind. Why do you think people are so obsessed with with this different phenomena, and it seems that it's getting bigger, broader, or do you think it's always had this huge allure to it, and people are just becoming more willing to admit that they believe?
Oh, geez. Yeah, there's a lot in all those questions. Let's see if we can sort of tackle them one at a time. I mean, okay, so, as you know, my last book, Ghostland, An American History in Haunted Places, was about, haunted spaces all around the country, the Winchester House, the LaLaurie Mansion in New Orleans, Salem, Massachusetts, stuff like that. And I think, one of the things I think we can all agree is, the belief in ghosts is pretty universal. You know, it goes back, to at least the ancient Greek, they believed in ghosts, whatever. It's very stable. It's very prevalent. I know there are a lot of skeptics out there, but I, we can all agree that there's always a huge population of people who believe in ghosts and life after death. And I guess with this book, it's like, I grew up on, that Time Life Unexplained Mystery series. Right. And, do you remember the Leonard Nimoy show In Search Of, which was
certainly do.
Yeah. So I grew up on all that stuff, and I grew up, loving, Bigfoot, the Abominable Snowman, Loch Ness Monster, all that stuff. But I guess, up until a couple of years ago, I kind of assumed that compared to something like ghosts, it was a much smaller, kind of much more niche kind of belief, particularly nowadays. Like, I kind of assumed that stuff was big in the 70s and maybe into the 80s, but it kind of fallen away. And so I'm poking around online, and Chapman University does this survey every year where they ask people about these beliefs. And, I this was like 2016 or something. I found the survey for that year that said that 14% of Americans believe in Bigfoot, which is, if you do the numbers, that's something like 42 million people, which is a lot, So suddenly I thought, I thought this was maybe kind of a minor thing compared to ghosts. And it's certainly not as prevalent as belief in ghosts, but it's a significant portion of the population. And that's kind of what got me started, sort of trying to figure out, what's going on here? Why are we still hunting for this stuff? When it seems like by now, we probably would have found one of these things if they actually were out there, I don't, maybe not, but it's kind of curious, kind of trying to figure out kind of where that came from. And I ended up kind of folding it in alongside the history of UFOs and aliens for reasons I've ultimately found some kind of sympathetic resonances there between the two of them. And then the third aspect, which again, I was surprised at how popular a belief this is the belief in the lost cities of Atlantis and Lemuria. So that's kind of how I got started on this, is, kind of moving out from ghosts, looking for something else that, seems similar, but yet seem to exist in a kind of different landscape, in a different world. I'd be curious of your thoughts, but when I think about haunted places, when I think about ghosts, I almost always think about architecture. I think about buildings, right? Every so often there's like a haunted cemetery or maybe a haunted forest, but it's always like a house or a hotel or a prison or something like that, right? It seems sort of like baked into the idea that ghosts live in buildings, I guess. And this stuff, where is Bigfoot? Bigfoot is out in the forest, but Loch Ness Monster is in in a lake. The aliens are out in the Nevada desert at Area 51. And so it was sort of like, it was a way for me to kind of approach this from a kind of different vantage point of sort of, rather than kind of going around looking at buildings and how buildings kind of attract and gather hauntings, I could look at kind of wilderness spaces and how wilderness spaces seem to be populated by this other kind of weird creature that I kind of wanted to delve into. I don't know how many of your questions I answered just there, but I can't remember them all anymore anyways.
No, it's good because it's kind of a nice broad stroke to much of what we discussed. But there's the concept of sacred geometry that might be built into some of these structures. Is it where these buildings lie that create the hauntings? Is it the element of humanity that chooses to stay there? I had a great conversation I mentioned from time to time with a friend of mine. The best conversations always happen over a cold beer in a bar, right? And as we were discussing, why do you think that ghosts are so basic and rudimentary? Why do they knock? Why is it always get out? Why is it always very territorial sense? Because you would think that in that aspect of our humanity, existing past our body, we would become more of an enlightened being as opposed to this miserly kind of curmudgeon that would just hang around in a location and worry about who's touching their stuff. And she brought up this point. She said, you know, I think that what this is that wherever we go, the best of us goes there. Whether you want to call it heaven or the next plane of existence or reincarnation, what's left behind is kind of what we shed, the garbage, the anger, the resentment, the guilt, the, you know, just all of the garbage part of us, the base instincts, which would explain why a spirit feels territorial to a location. It's its animal instinct. This is its home. That's all it really knows. Why its communication is very rudimentary with bangs and flickerings of light and something that it's just more about the energy release than a concerted conversation that it might try to have with you. And just kind of going through those elements, it's made sense to me of why old hospitals and, you know, insane asylums or prisons would be haunted. You'd think that would be the last place that you would want to stay as a soul. But if all that's left behind is that base element of our nature, the garbage, that seems to make sense to me. What do you make of something like that?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. It triggers in my mind. I don't know if you've seen this movie, A Ghost Story, that came out a couple of years ago with Casey Affleck, where he wears a sheet.
The sheet, right?
Yeah, yeah. Which that's really what it reminds me of. Is, you know, this. I mean, and yeah, if your listeners haven't seen it, I love that. It's sort of, it's not scary. It's sort of haunting and melancholic in this kind of weird way. But it's a really beautiful film. But yeah, that kind of sense of, like, you know, the thing that is kind of the part of you that's just kind of lingering on, that doesn't exactly even know where to go, that just kind of hangs around for lack of a better thing to do or something, I guess. But, you know, I guess, you know, with ghosts, you know, it's also the fact that what we're talking about with ghosts is we're talking about, you know, some version of humans, right? You know, some version of their soul or their
right.
echo or something like that. And, you know, so yeah, so in some sense, of course, they're going to exist in spaces that define human civilization. They're going to exist in, you know, hospitals and houses and stuff like that. And, you know, with Bigfoot and, you know, aliens in particular, out of, you know, all the things that I looked at in this book, you know, these are things that are they sort of uncannily echo humans, but are distinctly not, right? You know, like the Bigfoot idea is sort of like, you know, this is the missing link. This is the thing that is sort of animal, but sort of, you know, right up to the line of what is human, and sort of, you know, like troubling that line between human and animal. Whereas, you know, the aliens are, you know, kind of on the other end of the spectrum. They're sort of, you know, the next level of evolution. They're the advanced sort of things. And so they are, you know, again, sort of just on the other side of how we see ourselves. And I think of, again, I think of, like, you know, where are those things going to exist? They're going to exist just outside of civilization, right? They're going to exist, like, just in the desert, you know, just outside of Las Vegas or you know, the Redwoods just north of the Bay Area and that kind of stuff. So, like, yeah, it's sort of interesting to think about, like, with ghosts, it feels like the difference between you and the ghost is a question of time, is a question of memory and history. Whereas with some of these other stuff, the difference is one of space. You know, they're like in another place from you. I don't know if that makes any sense at all.
No, I completely get that. I completely get that. And, you know, there's been this ongoing debate now that, you know, so many people are in these camps. The ghosts exist, but cryptids and aliens probably not. Or cryptids exist and ghosts and aliens are ridiculous. Or aliens exist and there's no way or proof of anything else. But it's starting to seem, and I'm wondering if you're seeing this in your research, that it's kind of becoming all encompassed under one umbrella now, this kind of concept of multi-dimension, alternate reality, whatever you want to refer to it as, that these things may all coexist in a place and time where they're all aware of each other more than we are aware of them. And it, could it be because of our self-awareness, because of our self-absorbed nature. We're always in, you know, in the moment of right now, worried really about us. We're not noticing things that may be hiding right in plain sight.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think this is one of the things that really surprised me in my research, because when I started, I had this clear understanding that, you know, okay, you know, Bigfoot, real or not, was a, you know, kind of primate, you know, of some kind, you know, some kind of, you know, relative or descended to us, whereas, you know, extraterrestrials, you know, again, believe them or not, are, you know, these, you know, triangle shaped dudes with thin bodies and long fingers and, you know, big black eyes and that kind of stuff. And when I started interviewing people and sort of, you know, kind of asking around, I kept finding people who would describe what they were seeing as a kind of amalgamation of all these things, right? So, you know, I talked to this woman who was an Apache elder in Dulce, New Mexico, who described seeing a UFO she'd seen a UFO a couple times, but this one time, this sort of Bigfoot creature emerges from this UFO. And she has this conversation where the Bigfoot alien, I guess for lack of a better term, you know, told her that you know, they were the Apache elders, and they were coming back to the Earth now, that it was sort of the end of days, you know, sort of this apocalyptic vision, and these things, which, you know, I would have classified as, you know, these kind of non-human primates, were in fact, you know, spaceship flying, you know, Apache elders, which I thought was a really interesting kind of, you know, again, kind of like melding of a lot of these strands. And I saw that again in upstate New York when I hung out with some Bigfoot researchers up there, who, you know, one of whom described, you know, Bigfoot again as an alien who travels on flying saucers and was about ready to make their presence known, but we needed to do two things first. We needed to dismantle our nuclear arsenals and solve climate change. And until we did that, you know, they were going to stay kind of hidden in the forest. So again, it's sort of like, it seems like there's more and more people who have taken, you know, what I had long assumed to be kind of separate strands, and now kind of merging them all together into, yeah, this kind of like much more kind of hybrid and open-ended kind of paranormal situation.
So, all right. I love that you and I can have this conversation. And Tim, feel free to chime in on this. One aspect of this, Colin, that bothers me. And, you know, again, are we now saying that Bigfoot are aliens? Because we've run out of theories to explain a zoological aspect of this beast. But more importantly, I think it's interesting and says something about the human nature that we ascribe rules. Every rule seems to be something that is really, let's be honest, unobtainable. It's been the driving force that makes me insane on this show for 15 years. Oh no, the aliens are ready to make their presence known as soon as we can come together as a race.
Right.
As soon as we're able to peacefully get along. It's really great that these rules are set in, knowing it's unobtainable. This is, and I'm not trying to be the naysayer here, but over our historical span, there's never been a peaceful moment for humanity. We're constantly conquering, killing, and murdering. Even now, in the most woke part of our lives, where everything is offensive to everybody and everybody needs to be more aware of what they say and how they, I don't think it's driving us together. That's creating more of a division, putting us even further away from that goal of let's all come together. But Tim, 15 years of doing this, does that answer ever get under your skin as much as it bothers me?
Oh, it completely gets under my skin. I don't know why people assume that we're as enlightened as a species that has much better technology and would have a much more enlightened outlook than we would if they could travel the stars and come to this point here, and why we wouldn't be just a giant petri dish to be observed. You know where I'm going with this?
Yes.
Yeah. Why bother come here? I mean, what if we, unless we've got something really valuable for, I mean,
well, that's the thing. We don't have anything valuable.
Yeah. We do. We do, gentlemen. What we have is, we are the great reality TV show for the rest of the universe.
Exactly. That's all it is. It's this great. It's this great. It's not even an experiment. I think what people don't realize is pardon my language, we're a giant shit show to watch. And that's essentially, if we were scientists that, if we're the scientists that go to different planets to see what's there, and we poke and prod and test to see what exactly was on this planet, or try to see what the history of the moon and Mars is. Well, if an alien culture is coming here and they have a real live petri dish or culture dish that they can poke and prod into and see what makes us tick, well, that's all they're doing.
You know, I guess this gets back a little bit to what Dave was saying is, you know, one of the things I did in this book is I did my best to kind of keep an open mind, but, you know, also have a little, you know, healthy skepticism just because, I just want to try and understand things as best I could. And so I tried to kind of trace the history of a lot of these beliefs and see how they evolved through the years. And particularly with UFOs and aliens, I found what you're talking about here about this, you know, this like proof that we keep sort of, you know, waiting for, that keeps deferring the expected outcome. I feel like that's a real core component of the history of, you know, UFO belief. And maybe you guys know this, or maybe your listeners know this, about this woman, Dorothy Martin from 1955, who became a kind of important person in my book and sort of trying to understand what was going on here. But Dorothy Martin was a Illinois housewife who began getting messages from a character from Venus who told her that the Earth was going to flood in a giant flood at the end of the year that was going to wipe out civilization, but that this Venusian would come down with a flying saucer and take up Dorothy and some of her core believers and to safety. Right. So she gets this group together, kind of waiting for the end of the world. And unbeknownst to her, one of the people in her group is this sociologist, Leon Festinger, who has infiltrated the group because he wants to write about them. And Festinger coins this term that we still use today, which is cognitive dissonance. But it's he coins it in reaction to what happens with Dorothy Martin. So December 21st, 1955 comes. And I don't know if you are aware of this, but the world did not end that
Wait,
day.
Wait, what?
Yeah,
check
no.
Calendar.
No.
Tim, check the calendar. I think Colin might be wrong.
Well, right, the world did not end 65 years ago. And also, spoiler alert, the UFOs did not arrive. Right. So what happens to Dorothy Martin's group is some people in her, you know, she's got a couple dozen followers at that point. Some people give up. They're like, well, I guess that's wrong. I'm going to go back to my 9-to-5 job. But the ones who stay, including Dorothy Martin, they really double down on it, right? They really are like, okay, maybe we got the date wrong, or, you know, I don't know, we garbled the message somehow, but it's still happening. And so, you know, Festinger's term for this cognitive dissonance is this thing of like, what happens when your belief system is out of line with the facts, when the facts show up and they completely contradict your belief system? Like one of two things. Like some of us will shift our belief system, you know, like, oh, okay, I got the facts wrong, going to change my mind, no big deal. Other people will stick to that belief system, even if it means starting to, you know, discard the facts or start increasingly looking for kind of, you know, more and more elaborate, you know, mechanisms to explain why the facts don't come together. And so, you know, what I see when you look at the history of UFOs is you see, like in the 40s and 50s particularly, everybody is sure this is just a matter of time. You know, like there's sightings every day. You know, we're all going to see it. We're all going to see it. And then what happens is, you know, they don't show up, right? You know, 50s turn into the 60s. We still don't see them. We still don't see them. So people have to come up with an explanation for why they're not there, right? And the obvious solution for, I think, you know, most people is the idea of a government cover up, right? You know, like that's the kind of elegant solution to this problem, right? You know, the reason we're not seeing them is because, you know, they're, you know, the government's kept them under wraps. They're at Area 51 or whatever. So this is all just a kind of long way of answering your question of like, you know, these requirements that get put on, you know, whoever these creatures or beings or whatever are before they'll show up, you know, we gotta get to world peace or something like that. These also seem to be a way of managing a kind of perpetual deferral of an event that keeps happening. You know, like it's a way of you know, resolving the problem, you know, this kind of really difficult problem of like, if these things exist, where the heck are they? And, you know, this idea of like, well, they're there, but they're hiding, and we'll see them as soon as we dismantle the nuclear weapons. That's it. You know, like that becomes a way of kind of explaining that gap. I don't know if that makes any sense or not.
Right. Completely. Well, that's what I was saying is, do you think these are self-imposed beliefs we're giving to ourselves, or let's take the other route that there are these beings and that they are communicating? Are they giving us this deadline really in hopes that we will come together as a people, or because it will create more chaos? Because in trying to come together and make a plan seems to create even more anarchy than in the concept of just creating a plan itself.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it would be, yeah, I mean, I'm pretty open-minded about whether or not, you know, there's stuff out there. And I feel like it would be hard for me to project my mind into the thought process of a non-human consciousness, if that makes sense. Like, I don't know what a giant squid is thinking. And it would be hard for me to understand, you know, like what an alien might be thinking as well. So I think it becomes a question for me of like, how do we process the signals we're getting when we can't even remotely begin to imagine, you know, the thinking mechanism that might be sending those signals.
Hey, it's your old buddy, Tim, your producer and co-host of Darkness Radio. About to tell you about how I've been skipping trips to the grocery store and eating better with America's number one meal kit, HelloFresh. You can get fresh, pre-measured ingredients and mouth-watering seasonal recipes delivered right to your door. That's right, right to your door, skipping the grocery store, the trips to the grocery store, and making home cooking fun, easy, and affordable again with America's number one meal kit, HelloFresh. Let me tell you, HelloFresh's recipes are incredibly delicious. Oh my gosh. I look forward to seeing that box show up right there on the doorstep every week and getting those wonderful recipes that I know I'm not going to put a whole lot of effort into. There's no stress for me. It's all right there on those cards, and it's so wonderful just to put it all together and look like a chef. Of course, I'm far from a chef, but just looking like it's so effortless. And it is. It's so effortless. It's so easy. And it doesn't take that much time at all to put together the wonderful recipes from HelloFresh. HelloFresh offers so many recipes to choose from each week to help you break out of your recipe rut. There's something for everyone, including low-calorie, vegetarian, and family-friendly recipes every week. HelloFresh offers fresh, high-quality ingredients every week for a super flavorful experience. And you know, over 90% of ingredients are sourced directly from growers to ensure the freshest recipes are delivered to your door. Now, HelloFresh offers contactless delivery, which is important in this day and age, to your doorstep for easy home cooking with the family. HelloFresh cuts out stressful meal planning and grocery store trips, so you can enjoy cooking and getting dinner on the table in just about 30 minutes or even 20 minutes with their quick recipe options. And you can save up to 28% by using HelloFresh versus your grocery store shopping trips. HelloFresh is also incredibly flexible, so it fits you and your family and your lifestyle in this incredibly hectic time with the coronavirus, with the pandemic, with everything that's going on, with the changing landscape that's going on in today's society. What's nice about HelloFresh is they will easily change your delivery days or your food preferences whenever you need to. They'll also allow you to skip a week whenever you need to. Also, feeding your family has never been easier. They've taken in provided larger box sizes for more servings and more savings. Also, the great thing that Dave and I love about HelloFresh is they're committed to giving back to the community. Did you know that HelloFresh has donated over 2.5 million meals to charity in 2019? And this year, they're stepping up their food donations amid the coronavirus crisis, which is something we absolutely love about HelloFresh. Now, let me tell you, when you go in to order HelloFresh, there's a couple of recipes that I've made over the last couple of weeks that I've absolutely loved that you're going to want to try. The mozzarella and herb chicken with roasted green beans and buttery couscous is absolutely wonderful. And you may be saying, buttery couscous? Couscous? Actually, couscous is a real good substitute for rice. And it's a little lighter on the carb side, too. That whole dish only takes 30 minutes to prepare. It's really quick, and it's really good for the family. And if you're looking at lightening the carb load a little bit, the mozzarella and herb chicken's really good. The Juicy Lucy Burgers is actually a Minnesota staple. We love our Juicy Lucy Burgers here in Minnesota, and it comes with a tomato onion jam and potato wedges. And actually, that meal in itself is really good, really quick, and takes about 40 minutes. And, oh my gosh, it's so good. And you got to try it. And then if you're looking for something that's also a little easier on the carb side, the seared steak with demi reduction plus garlic mashed potatoes and roasted carrots is so scrumptious. Oh, it's so good. And you're going to want to try that as well. It's a little more on the preparation side, about 45 minutes, but it's so worth it. And it's so delicious. Give it a try. The seared steak with demi reduction plus garlic mashed potatoes and roasted carrots at HelloFresh.com. America's number one meal kit. Now, you may say to yourself, Tim, how do I get in on this? Let me tell you how you're going to get in on this, because we're going to offer you a little something to get you started on HelloFresh. This is the great part. If you go right now to HelloFresh.com/80darkness and use the code 80darkness, that's 80darkness, you'll get a total of $80 off, including free shipping on your first box. How does that sound? Sounds pretty good, right? Additional restrictions apply. So please visit HelloFresh.com for more details. Again, get in on some great, great food, nutritious food, get it shipped directly to your doorstep, and get on a meal plan that's going to help you and your family in these hectic times during this pandemic. I'll guarantee you, once you start skipping those trips to the grocery store and getting America's number one meal kit, you're going to love planning out your meals this way. Give it a try right now. Go to HelloFresh.com/80darkness, 80darkness, and use code 80darkness to get a total of $80 off, including free shipping on your first box. Additional restrictions apply. Please visit HelloFresh.com for more details. One more time, HelloFresh.com/80darkness. Use the code 80darkness for a total of $80 off, including free shipping on your first box. HelloFresh.com/80darkness. Do it today.
Hi, everyone. This is Jillian with Court Junkie. Court Junkie is a true crime podcast that covers court cases and criminal trials using audio clips and interviews with people close to the cases. Court Junkie is available on Apple Podcasts and PodcastOne.com.
The unidentified mythical monsters, alien encounters, and our obsession with the unexplained. Colin Dickey, our guest. Again, the book link is in today's program information, so look that up and order the book. Make sure that you rate and review the book as well. I there's so many angles that we can look at with these different claims, you know, and I've spoken to people who I firmly believe really do think that they're in communication with aliens. And they'll get just enough information to make them a little dangerous. But then it always seems aliens will give them a specific date, July 4th, 1998. We are going to make our presence known over Las Vegas. Right? Now, they've given all this other great information, star maps, this, that, and the other things that people should not know. And then they give them the coup d'etat, they give them the date, and it doesn't come through. Was that, you know, Is that the way that aliens keep kind of cloaked as well? I'll make my communication. I have to use you a little bit. So we're gaining information. We're gleaning information. You're getting something from me. I'm getting something from you. But I've got to also leave you questionable in the minds of others so that there is no further poking or prodding from mainstream science. If I give you one or two nuggets that are completely insane, like a date we're going to be there and nothing shows up, that changes the parameters of everything, right? So then you question every part of the story, even the parts that they got right. It's an interesting facet to how that works. Betty and Barney Hill dealt with it. Travis Walton dealt with that and continues to deal with it. So many abductees will have these moments of unbelievable information that is sometimes found out later. Even Bob Lazar now, you know, many of the claims that he made years ago about the things that he saw that people, you know, kind of threw him under the bus and thought he was crazy. Here we are 20 years later, and lo and behold, through disclosure, we're finding that a lot of these different items, like the hand scanning unit he claimed to have had to go through in order to enter the facility, did exist. And there are some of these elements that now make the rest of his story even more plausible. It's really kind of an interesting route, because it seems like we're given this information on such a teetering foundation from less than reputable sources, aliens, Bigfoot, ghosts, demons, the djinn, whatever is telling us these things. So it's, you know, there's no way to give a solid answer on any one of this. And that therefore makes it easy to just dismiss and throw the baby out with the bathwater through all of this. Is that a frustrating element to your research as well, Colin?
I mean, that's really fascinating. When I'm listening to I can't help but think about the story of Paul Benowitz, which, again, you guys probably know the story. But, you know, this idea that, you know, Paul Benowitz was an Air Force contractor who lived on the edge of Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque. And he used to go out on his roof at night and, you know, look out over the Air Force Base. And he started seeing these weird flying ships that he couldn't explain, right? So, you know, they're sort of hovering above, you know, the Air Force Base and moving in ways that, you know, doesn't seem like they should be able to move, right? So, you know, he starts taking photos, he starts taking videos, he starts sharing them with his UFO networks. And so the Air Force shows up, and the Air Force says, you know, look, you know, we have UFOs, and we want to sort of give you some additional information, right? And so they give him this special computer, and they're like, this computer will receive, you know, these alien broadcasts, and you just need to decode them, and you know, we're going to be giving you some other information too. And later it comes out that all of this was a hoax put on by the Air Force in ways that you're exactly talking about, that what they were trying to do was to make Paul Benowitz look crazy. So they would sort of give him this information, and then he would go around and say, look, I've got this information about, you know, Majestic 12 or whatever. And then the Air Force would turn around and reveal that it was a hoax. This computer was just sort of, you know, shooting gibberish out at him. And, and it really destabilized Paul Benowitz in a way that, you know, according to some sources, he ended up, institutionalized for a time, because he kind of went down this really paranoid rabbit hole. And it was like, what appears, the best understanding that we have is whatever the Air Force had, they were worried that it was going to get out, and that, you know, Soviet spies were maybe going to learn about it, because, you know, again, if you're looking for top secret military, you know, stuff, why not go to UFO groups and see if they, you know, accidentally find something, right? So, you know, but rather than just go to this guy who was a patriotic American and say, you know, look, we would prefer you not to share these videos because they're classified or whatever, they decided to discredit him instead by just pushing all this garbage into him and really destabilizing his mental state. So it's like, that's the kind of, you know, Air Force version of what you're talking about. It's like, yeah, like, you know, somebody stumbles on a little bit of truth, and rather than just try and, you know, get them to keep it to themselves, you instead just flood them with a bunch of nonsense and garbage and hope that everybody just writes them off as a kook.
Well, let me ask both you and Tim this. This is something that kind of comes to mind at this point, and I'm curious what both of your takes are. We are, if anything, we are a boisterous country. We are a proud country who likes to strut and show off our superiority in everything. If we've got craft that can do one-tenth of what they say it can, these alien craft can do, why aren't we posturing more to show the rest of the world, you better think twice before you make another attack. Because, you know, the theory has always been, Colin, you know, he who commands the skies commands the war, right? Mm-hmm. If we had craft that could do this, just allowing the Russians or China or, you know, Korea to know what we have would be enough to make them second guess their next strike. Why aren't we doing that? Or do you believe that we are through, quote unquote, releasing of UFO information? In a way, this is telegraphing what we do have, but we're doing the plausible deniability. Oh, we don't know what that is. But hey, Russia, take notice. We've, you know, these craft are flying over our property. These craft are around us. Oh, yeah, we don't believe in UFOs. So what is that telegraphing to the rest of the world? We're not acknowledging UFOs. We're not acknowledging it's ours, but we're acknowledging that something is taking place over our skies, veiled threat. Or do you guys see where I'm going with this? I'm sorry?
I completely see where you're going. Do you, Colin, do you want to go first?
No, go for it, Tim.
Okay, so here's my theory on where Dave's going with this, and then Colin, if you want to follow up with it, you can. I've stated my theory on this many a times on the show, and I believe that a lot of UFO you see in the sky are man-made, not necessarily from another planet. So here's where I'm going to go with your question, Dave, and that's this. The reason why I don't believe the United States government, if they have the type of technology you're talking about, aerial technology, even if it was derived from alien technology or not, if they have advanced aerial technology in which they could use in a war or that type of, you know, in that type of a scenario, the reason why they wouldn't unveil it to other countries, I'm going to use it look around the world in the geopolitical spectrum right now, as far as nuclear weapons go. Every country out there, not necessarily superpowers, but it seems like every other country out there right now is developing a nuclear weapon. We have issues with South Korea. We have issues with Iran. We have issues with Pakistan. India is developing nuclear weapons. It's not just the privilege of a superpower to develop a nuclear weapon. So to say I have fighter jets or I have a craft that can house 2,000 people that I can shuttle to a different planet if I wish to, that type of technology could be used and abused by a lot of different countries on the planet. And why would you reveal your hand that you have technology that any other country on the planet or nation on the planet could use and abuse when you've got something in your hand that you don't want to reveal to anybody else, such as nuclear weapons? We've already used different treaties in the United Nations to try and ban nuclear weapons and get them off of the face of the planet to no avail. You can't do it. Everyone is proliferating when it comes to nuclear weapons. You can't get rid of them now. So why would you introduce yet another weapon into, or yet another variable? I won't call it a weapon. Another variable into the world's petri dish for it only to proliferate. I wouldn't. I'd keep it secret. If I've got it, I've got it in my reserve so that if I need it, I can bring it forward and use it.
Yeah, I think that makes sense to me. I mean, I think that, you know, Dave, what you're talking about, certainly, you know, when somebody like North Korea does a nuclear missile or, a nuclear weapon test, that seems to be exactly what you're talking about, the kind of like performing it for the world stage to say, look, we've got this. Don't mess with us. We can do this. We can use this on you. You know, back off. But, you know, but then there's also like, you know, the history of things like what was that World War II device, the Enigma machine that cracked the German codes, but they couldn't, right. even though they were getting actionable information, they couldn't act on that actionable information, because if they did, then the Germans would know that, you know, that their codes were busted. So they had to kind of like keep it under wraps, and in some case kind of let, Allied soldiers, you know, die that could have otherwise been saved, just because they were, you know, saving up that knowledge for just the right time. So, yeah, I mean, I am probably somewhere with Tim, you know, like I think, yeah, there's a lot of weird stuff out there that the military does that I can't even pretend to know. And I would not be surprised that they're sitting on technology that is far in advance of, you know, what we can imagine. I also think they're probably sitting on a lot of like really goofball nonsense. You know, I mean, there is, you know, there's declassified reports of, failed efforts to try and, you know, weaponize telekinesis and mind reading in the Defense Department. And then do you guys know about Operation Acoustic Kitty, which is one of my favorite things ever?
Yeah. Yes, I do. But for listeners that are not familiar, please inform
us. So Operation Acoustic Kitty was this idea the CIA had where they were going to implant bugs on house cats and then release the house cats in foreign embassies and consulates, with the idea being that they could use the cats to eavesdrop on confidential conversations with the Russians or the Chinese or whatever. They spent like $20 million on this project before they realized it turns out you cannot train a cat. You can't get a cat to go where you want it to go under any circumstances. And so it turned out to be a complete boondoggle. So I feel like, you know, some of this stuff, I wouldn't be at all surprised at something that, somebody maybe, you know, gets on footage and is convinced is, you know, advanced technology of an extraterrestrial may turn out to be, you know, a wacky Defense Department project that was, just kind of a boondoggle that somebody convinced the government to spend a couple $1 million on that went nowhere. But, you know, who knows? I've at the end of the day, I find myself quite agnostic about a lot of this stuff.
There was an article just this last week talking about Acoustic Kitty. There was an article out, Elon Musk. And I don't have the full concept memorized, but he's basically creating this new way that he believes that they can beam music right into
your brain. Yep.
Right. Yep. So if they're able to do that, then how terrifying is that concept? I mean, I love music, and if there's a way to do it and have a better way, and maybe for people that have auditory issues or are deaf, this will give them a way to hear it. It sounds exciting and amazing. To me, it sounds like we know how music can manipulate the brain. We know how music can elicit emotions, anger, sadness, inspiration, right? I mean, how powerful would that be at the moment of engagement? You start playing the Eye of the Tiger to your forces in their brain as they're, you know, going into combat mode. Right. I mean, just theoretically, it sounds like it could give you this. But if they're able to do that kind of brain feedback, what are they able to elicit back from the brain? What information are they, you know, they're seeming to give us something to make our lives better. I don't believe that doesn't happen without some kind of payback. Like, what are they going to get back out of us that this is going to teach them? And, I'm starting to sound like the creepy old man on the front porch shaking his fist at the kids worrying about, his lawn. I just, these things start to concern me that there is some reality to how we're continually manipulated in this country and around the world. I can't just blame our country. You know, all these countries have information that they are holding on to. Some are releasing it in really enigmatic ways. And, you know, they'll release their UFO files, but when you read through them, there's nothing really to bite into. There's some mysteries that are left unanswered, but there's never anything that definitively says, yes, we have something. So nobody's ever declassified anything in my knowledge. And Colin, maybe you've got a better handle on this, that really kind of gives us a stamp that, yeah, this is, look, finally Russia admitted UFOs exist, or Canada, or France, or Germany, or Uruguay. Nobody has ever released that definitive piece of information yet. They've given us cloaked information. They've given us things that seem to hint around to the existence of things, that are anomalous, but they there's nothing that that is that one stamp that makes us all feel like, ah. But people read into these instances and these reports whatever they want to, depending on what they go into with their belief systems.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, look, first of all, forget Eye of the Tiger. What if you could just project into your opponents or your enemies just really loud Muzak or something really just awful, you know, that they would just have to just like couldn't get it out of their brains. I mean, years ago, I wrote a piece about the hum, which I don't know if you guys have talked about on this show or not.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, right. So, and I, you know, like, and again, I mean, you know, I met so many different people had so many different theories for what it was, everything from just like cell phone towers to, to again, these malevolent brain waves being, you know, projected into people from the government. And, you know, that guy who, killed those folks at the Navy Yard, you know, he seemed to be under the delusion or under the impression that he was being, his brain was being poisoned by, you know, the hum or some version of that. So, yeah. So like, you know, these things are, some of this stuff doesn't, you know, I don't have a clear sense at this point, what the hum is. And, the guy that I profiled in that piece who, thought it was ultra low frequency waves has subsequently shifted his hypothesis. So I don't really know what the hum is anymore. Maybe you guys know more than I do, but I do know there's, you know, a lot of this stuff isn't fiction. It's happening, you know, right now.
That was hella timing you just had. As you start talking about the hum, it sounds like a B-52 bomber was loading in ready to drop on your house there. Were you hearing that?
Oh yeah, no, it was probably just something out of the nearby airport. But yeah, I did. Yeah.
You're like, have you heard about the hum? And it starts right. Amping up.
Oh, yeah.
We'll take a quick break. We've got more to talk about with our guest, Colin Dickey, when we return right here to Darkness Radio.
What are you doing in your free time? I hope you're playing Best Fiends. I certainly hope you are. If you're not playing Best Fiends, well, you should be. It's hours of fun that you can enjoy anytime. Best Fiends has challenging puzzles you can solve. It's got cute characters you can collect. And it's got new levels that's added every day to the game. I know I'm hooked. If you're anything like me, I know you're going to be too. You don't have Wi-Fi, you say? Well, no worries. You don't even need Wi-Fi. You don't need an internet connection to play Best Fiends. I'll tell you what I love about the game. Of course, the cute characters. I've got 20 out of the 154 possible characters you can have. I got my favorites. I got Dennis. I got Gordon. Dennis is like a cute little grasshopper character I just added this past week. Who's got some horizontal bombs. And you got Gordon. He's like my little scorpion character. And then I got Pop. He's like a cute little purple. He's kind of like a spiny goldfish character. Those are my little guys that I tend to be partial to. I got my characters. You've got the puzzle solving. I'm seeing things in different ways now, thanks to Best Fiends. My problem solving has gotten much better thanks to Best Fiends. There's lots of great things about Best Fiends that I love. Lots of great attributes that I've developed thanks to Best Fiends. I've gotten my friends and family into the game. They love playing Best Fiends. And of course, I've got lots of Facebook friends that I'm playing with thanks to Best Fiends. I am, of course, hooked up through Facebook. So I love playing the game with my friends and family. And of course, leapfrogging them and giving them gifts through Facebook, through Best Fiends as well. There are millions of downloads of Best Fiends everywhere. So everyone is playing this game. You should be playing this game too. I don't know why you're missing out on playing Best Fiends, but you got to get on this game as well. I'm telling you, the game is constantly changing. This isn't just a static game that once you've played all the levels, you're played out. It's a unique and exciting puzzle game unlike any other. Best Fiends is constantly updating this game. They update the game monthly. There's new levels, new events. It never gets old. There's deserts. There's oceans. There's mountain ranges. There's new slugs. There's new enemies. There's new levels. Every time I turn around, the puzzles are changing. It never gets old. I'm always facing something new. And I tell you, I don't think I've ever seen the same board twice. And I'll tell you, you think you may need hours and hours and hours to play this game? You don't. if you've only got a couple of minutes. You could be in some random weird place. Maybe you're waiting for your coffee to brew. Maybe your partner's watching TV and you only got a couple of minutes. Pick up the game, play it for a couple of minutes, put it back down. It's okay. Maybe you only have time to play a quick level or two. Do it. Just get in, play the game, get out. Go ahead and do it. And again, you don't have Wi-Fi access, you don't have cell data, no big deal. Pick up the game, play it, put it back down. It's okay. Best Fiends is convenient and accessible and ready for you at all times. Best Fiends has thousands of levels already with new levels, events, and characters added every month. It's hours of fun right at your fingertips. And again, you can even play offline. With over 100 million downloads and tons of five-star reviews, Best Fiends is a must-play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends.
The unidentified, mythical monsters, alien encounters, and our obsession with the unexplained. Colin Dickey, our guest. That's the name of the book, out July 21st. Make sure that you order it. We've got a link up for it on today's program information, so make sure you click it and order this book. It is phenomenal. Colin, let's dive into the book itself some more. And I'd like to know personally, if you're willing to share with us, what aspects leave you most convinced that something does exist? Monsters, aliens, ghosts? Where do you kind of fall in on this?
I went through a lot of different sightings and, various creatures, various aliens, various UFO sightings. And, I try my best to keep an open mind, but I also try to, not just, chase after every, lens flare or, shot of Venus in the sky or something. I try to really assess, what did I think, were there other plausible explanations, that kind of stuff. And I think by the end of the book, I'd found a couple that I'm not sure I have a real clear explanation for one way or another. And I just try and leave my readers with that. But, one thing, for example, when we talk about cryptids, I think, it's usually Bigfoot and Nessie and maybe, Chupacabra or the Jersey Devil, which, really get top billing, right? They're the ones that everybody thinks about. People don't think as much about the Gloucester Sea Serpent. And I feel like the Gloucester Sea Serpent is really getting short shrift. If you're going to talk about a solid, unexplained cryptid sighting, I don't think it's the Gimlin Patterson video of Bigfoot. I think that, primatologists have looked at that and they've got some skepticism that leads me to think, it might have been a hoax or something like that. The Nessie photographs, I love those photographs, but I also similarly, I'm not entirely convinced that those weren't hoaxed. But the Gloucester Sea Serpent, which I don't know if folks here know, but basically, in 1820 or thereabouts outside of Cape Ann, Massachusetts in Gloucester Bay, this sea serpent appears, right? And people describe it anywhere between 50 and 100 feet long. Its diameter, according to one eyewitness, is like the width of a beer barrel, so pretty big creature. And the thing about the Gloucester Sea Serpent is normally with these sightings, it's like one guy, right? It's like one guy stumbling through a clearance, sees Bigfoot, fumbles for his camera, gets a blurry photograph, and Bigfoot is gone, right? Or something like that, And they'll stake out there weeks and weeks and weeks, never see whatever they saw ever again, right? Gloucester Sea Serpent was seen by like dozens, if not hundreds of people. And it was seen not just once, it was seen over the course of like 2 weeks, basically. If you went out to Cape Ann, Massachusetts during August of 1820, I think that's the year, you could see this thing. It was out there. It was out there every day. It was not hiding. It was visible. You could see it from boats. You could see it from the shore. People were taking day trips out from Boston to see it. Daniel Webster, the dictionary guy, was like one of the people who was like, hey, I'm not doing anything on a Saturday. Let's go out and see the Gloucester Sea Serpent. So this was like, really, really well documented sighting. And so, So what happens is that like the scientific community in Massachusetts are like, we should figure out what this thing is. So they're trying to figure, they get a bunch of people to give a, you know, kind of sworn affidavit testimony as to what they've seen. And then this farmer finds this, this odd looking serpent who, he kills on his property near the beach. And it sort of looks like a normal snake, but it's got these weird ridges and bumps. And the consensus is, oh, this must be the baby of whatever it was that we, you know, we've been seeing, right? So this is just the juvenile form of the sea serpent. So they taxonomize this thing. They give it a name, Scoliopis atlanticus, I think it's, you know, whatever. And they taxidermy it and they stick it in a museum. They're like, great, we found a new species. Cool. No big deal. And then subsequently, like 20 or 30 years later, another biologist is looking at this taxidermied specimen and is like, hold on, this is not a new sea serpent. This is a snake with a very bad case of rickets. And it turns out that, you know, that's what it was. It was just, you know, a really weirdly deformed snake. So then this, you know, science is basically like, well, okay, then the whole thing is a hoax. And that's where I kind of stop. And I'm like, wait a second. I mean, I get that they messed up here by seizing on this diseased snake, thinking it was a new kind of sea serpent, but it doesn't explain all those eyewitnesses. And that's one of the ones where I'm really stumped. I don't have a good, you know, skeptical scientific answer for it. I think that if one were looking for really solid cryptozoological sightings, far and away more so than most of the Bigfoot sightings and the Loch Ness sightings or, you know, any of these other things, the Gloucester sea serpent is a really hard one to dismiss if you're a skeptic.
Yeah, that's a pretty interesting story. I'd never heard that. You're right, though. Just because you can find something that's an offshoot of an eyewitness doesn't mean that that's necessarily what the main thing was that was seen by all of those people. Now, is that something that continued to be seen over a long period of time, or was it a one and done situation?
No, it never came back. So yeah, it was in Gloucester Bay for about 2 weeks, I think. And then it moved on to, you know, warmer pastures or whatever. And yeah, and it hasn't ever been seen since. So that is, you know, it's weird and confusing. I have a feeling if something were to show up today in 2020 and be that visible to that many people for that long amount of time, we would know what it was, you know, for better or for worse. We would either understand it to be a new species or, you know, we would recognize, oh, maybe it's, you know, I don't know, an oarfish or something like that, you know, but we would know what it was. But just given the state of things at the time, and you couldn't capture something like that, and, you know, whatever, there weren't photographs in the same way, or there weren't photographs at all, you know, it sort of exists in this kind of prehistory of cryptozoology, right? Because it exists before, you know, before Nessie, before Bigfoot, before there starts to be a, you know, kind of organized, you know, methodology for what cryptid hunters, you know, do and stuff like that. So it predates all that, and that's probably why it doesn't get the same press. But I think, again, if you know, by any standards of what a cryptid hunter would be looking for, I think this has got it in spades.
Very cool. What are some of the other encounters? Let's even talk alien encounters that really kind of piqued your curiosity in this new book.
You know, I have a friend who is a longtime alien enthusiast, and for part of the research of the book, I drove with him through the Southwest. We started out in California. We drove to Rachel, Nevada, into Vegas, and then Socorro, New Mexico, where the Lonnie Zamora sighting was. And again, the Lonnie Zamora sighting is another one that I have a little bit of problems dismissing out of hand. You know, this was a cop who was, you know, well-regarded. He wasn't known for flights of fancy. He was out on the beat. I'm trying to remember what year this was. But you know, he was chasing another car who was speeding. So he was trying to pull this car over, and then he saw this weird thing out of the corner of his eye, this like sort of silver object that was sort of landing in this aurora. So he breaks off and he goes and he sees this sort of silver thing that sort of, you know, part of it looks like it might be a car, but it doesn't really have the shape of a car. And there's these two kind of smallish figures who seemed to be working on it, but he, you know, as he's, the sun's in his eyes, so he can't quite see everything that's going on. And by the time he gets close, this thing takes off, and you know, there's this big flash of light from the engines, and he, you know, he's kind of knocked back a little bit, and he, you know, and then this thing sort of whisks off into the air, and there's this burnt patch on the ground that's left behind, and that's the only trace. And again, you know, UFO investigators come out, Project Blue Book comes out, they, you know, they do their thing, and even Project Blue Book, which, you know, is sort of invested in, you know, dispelling a lot of these things, comes away thinking, you know, Lonnie Zamora definitely saw something, or, you know, he believes he saw, you know, it's basically like, you know, there's something happened. This is not, this guy is not making it up. It's not a hoax. He's not, you know, mentally deficient in any way, shape or form. And there was definitely this, you know, charred patch of, you know, blackened earth on the ground. And beyond that, it's really hard to say what it is, but it's also really hard to just dismiss the whole thing and walk away from it. So that's another, you know, again, I mean, you know, there are,
but, and that story is interesting. First of all, it was April 24th, 1964.
Oh, okay.
But what's fascinating about that story too, is that this wasn't your quintessential nighttime encounter. This happened at 5:50 in the afternoon.
Yeah. 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 And I think that's again, when I was looking at sort of the history of these things, one of the things you see is like, is oftentimes the earliest versions of these sightings, you know, or, you know, whatever, often don't fit the mold. And what happens is, over time, it kind of settles into a routine, you know, and like you think of like alien abductions, like the earliest alien abductions, you know, the Betty and Barney Hill story, that didn't really fit the mold of what would eventually become kind of the quintessential alien abduction story. And you can almost see the way in which, once these things sort of, you know, get into pop culture, they start to almost create a feedback loop where you get some of these kind of more dubious, you know, abduction stories, and, you know, you kind of read the transcript, you read the history, and it feels very much like the, you know, the people doing the hypnosis are basically feeding them, you know, these kind of accepted pop cultural tropes, and then under hypnosis, they're sort of spitting them back. And so, yeah, so it's like the earliest sightings are often the most interesting because they don't fit the mold. They're very different and weird. And for me, I think that it's because they're a little bit off that they don't look like the other ones, that they have a slightly, they have a slight more ring of authenticity to them than the ones that sort of, you know, fit the kind of archetypal X-Files mode, if that makes any sense.
Completely. Very cool. You know, and Betty Andreessen Luca, she had her own encounter, and we talked to her on the phone on our show here, and there were strange things happening while we were talking with her and her husband on the line. Some of these cases that you hear are just so fascinating that it's hard to discount them. I mean, within Minnesota, and Tim, you're going to have to help me with the location. There was a really fascinating UFO encounter with a police car here. As a matter of fact, they still have that car on display where the craft flew over it. The antenna bent, not like it kinked. It's like it bent from the heat and exhaust of this craft going past it. And those are pretty plausible eyewitnesses. It's the cops, right? In an era when there wasn't supersonic jets flying or something that would have been that close to the ground to have a physical impact on a vehicle like this. What does that leave you with then, Colin? When you know, some of the stuff it's easy to say is you look at Venus and you're mistaken, or there are those Chinese lanterns that people let go at anniversaries, deaths, birthdays, weddings. Right. And they're sighted in the skies. Anytime Tim and I hear about the, you know, oh, there was a large cluster of orange balls in the sky that are flying by, I give no stock to that because, unfortunately, that has been proven too many times to be those Chinese lanterns, especially in clusters. But when you start to hear, you know, where you've got reliable people having these encounters, people whose job it is to be eyewitnesses. And we understand police are fallible. People make mistakes. You know, nobody's above reproach when it comes to eyewitness encounters. But when you've got people who see these type of things and are reporting them that, you know, aren't the unwashed masses, you know, drinking moonshine from the back of a pickup truck when they witness this, but, you know, police in pursuit, pilots, you know, things like that. What do you think is going on? Do you think that we are seeing craft from other worlds, other universes, outer space, or do you think that 95% of these are man-made items that they're just testing?
Hey, first of all, you know, no disrespect to people who are unwashed and drinking moonshine out of the back of their trucks. You know,
without them, I wouldn't have been born.
That's a noble American pursuit, and we value all of anyone, including myself, who occasionally drinks moonshine out of the back of a truck. You know what I think? Okay, so for me, you know, and again, this book was a real process of self-discovery, because I really had to ask myself a lot of times, like, what do I think? Do I accept this? Do I let this go? Do I, you know, just double down on, you know, skepticism and rationality and just assume that it couldn't be? This couldn't have happened because it doesn't make any sense, and I'm just going to deny it. And you know what? I came back again and again to Charles Fort. You know, and I think I take Fort as a real kind of North Star in my understanding of how this stuff works. Because you know, again, I'm sure a lot of you guys know this already, but like you know, Fort starts out writing you know, these books about how human behavior is controlled by radio waves sent from the planet Mars and, you know, whatever. It's a very elaborate, bizarre, nonsensical theory. Can't get the book published. You know, the manuscript gets destroyed. We only know what it was about through, you know, letters that he wrote. But that's like, you know, if he had just written that, I mean, he would have been, you know, kind of one and done, and we would have, you know, just kind of moved on from life. Nobody would really remember Charles Fort except as some sort of weird oddity from the 19 teens. You know, what he does with the Book of the Damned, which I think is so important and so valuable, is he steps back from trying to offer an overarching theory for some of this stuff. You know, he doesn't go out of his way to say, This is the explanation for this, you know, weird phenomenon. He just simply says, here's some weird phenomenon. It doesn't fit into the normal way we think about science or religion, but it's well documented. It seems to have happened, and we should be aware that these things exist. And I think that is how I tried to approach some of this stuff, is this idea that anytime I tried to offer myself a theory for any of these things, it started to feel weird. I started to think it was like, you know, well, this is pretty hokey, or I can't support anything like that. But anytime I just kind of sat with the experience, you know, as it was given to me, it just kind of opens up your mind to all these new possibilities, right? You know, like, you know, another good one that I single out in the book is the Lawndale, Illinois event of 1977, when, you know, this woman's child gets picked up by this 6-year-old child gets picked up by these two weird large birds. Right. And, you know, she chases the birds for like 10, 20 feet before they drop her kid. And, you know, what the heck was it? Was it, you know, like, you know, the best she comes up with is a condor. But condors don't go after live prey. They can't lift anything as heavy as a 6-year-old child. And condors were not flying around Illinois at the time. They were near extinct, and they were in California, right? So it's like, so the skeptical response to that is to say, oh, well, it was somehow a condor, but that doesn't make any sense. And that's ludicrous, you know, but I don't necessarily need to go all the way to, you know, ergo, I have some, you know, kind of overarching synthetic theory about, you know, these kind of secret things. I just want to kind of live in that moment and say, this weird thing seems to have happened. Nobody knows what it was, but it's part of our historical record. It's part of our reality. It's something I think is fun and cool to sit with and try and expand your mind a little bit. I don't know if that's a cop out or not, but that's how I got to.
Yeah, Tim, let's get going. This guy's copping out already. We don't need this nuts. No, I appreciate that. It is, right? Some people, I like that you're willing to kind of just remain mystified and enjoy the mystery of what it is. You know, so many people like myself, I admit it, I want to put it in a nice contextual little box and feel better about myself. maybe it's my OCD. But it's, you know, it's the way humans work, right? We want to, that's why pareidolia is so prominent in this field. We want to make sense of these random bits of information we're getting and have them come out tidy. And I guess that's, you know, I'll continue to bang the drum for this guy as long as we do our show and as long as he maintains the way he's been. But, you know, so many of the skeptics out in the field, You've got, in my estimation, you've got kind of the James Randis and Joe Nickel, who to me are kind of the extremists, the nothing will ever impress them. Right. Then you've got the Brad Radfords or Ben Radfords, who are fascinating. They're able to have a contextual conversation with you, explore this, but still maintain their high level of skepticism. Then you've got, Dr. Michael Shermer, who's kind of, been this great face for logical thinking and exploration. And, there's been a few times we've been around each other when something weird happens, and he just pats me on the shoulder and he says, it's okay just to say that was weird and I don't know a rational explanation. Let's just enjoy that moment. And I'm like, but doctor, you said this. And he goes, I'm telling you that 90% of what we experience is misunderstood or misinterpreted by the brain because it's trying to compartmentalize things. But in this instance, I don't have an answer and I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
And I respect that aspect I wish I had that laid back nature that I could just, that's really cool.
I think what you're describing, that need to know, I mean, that is such a huge part of human nature. And it's totally, you're not an outlier. I mean, we all have that. So when I talk about, this kind of like Freudian call to resist the explanation, I mean, I get that is really going against human nature. And in fact, Charles Fort couldn't even do this all the time. In some of his later books, he would pose theories that when I get to his theories, I'm like, come on, this is ludicrous. But like, you were doing so good up until that moment. You know, this whole thing that there's like a floating universe of blood above the skies that every so often sort of, coagulates into, frogs dropping out of the sky. I'm just like, I can't go there with you, Charles. But, it was a real fun ride up until that point. So, yeah, I mean, it's we all do it. It's all and there's nothing wrong with it. And you're right. It is, it's a lot of it is sort of searching for patterns and trying to find some kind of order amongst the chaos. And I think that's just who we are. So, yeah, like to stop and try and resist that and try and sort of push back and keep that open mind, without going to skepticism, without going to, immediate naive belief and, to try and kind of walk that line between I'm not good at it myself. It's like a meditative practice. You got to kind of try and kind of, develop it every day. But,
very cool. Where do you want to go next with the book and some of the other stories? I know we don't want to give much away because obviously we want listeners to pick up the book and read for themselves. But if you had a few other tantalizing teases that really kind of stand out to you, what would they be?
The other thing that I don't think I've done an interview yet without talking about would be the Great Kentucky Meat Shower, which you
wait, know, what?
Are you not familiar with the Great Kentucky Meat Shower?
Don't talk down to me like that, Dickie. All right. this just sounds like some bad movie I would have caught on Cinemax at 2:30 in the morning at some point.
Exactly.
The Great Kentucky Meat Shower. Tim, we missed it when we were trying to put up a Southern band in the 70s. That should have been the name of it.
That sounds like a good Southern rock band. Yeah.
Yeah. Please, good friend.
We are the Great Kentucky Meat Shower. Okay. So cast your mind back to March 1876.
Oh, it's cast.
Olympia Springs, Kentucky, which is sort of near the border of West Virginia. It's a cloudless day, not a cloud in the sky. And this woman, I forget her first name, her last name is Crouch, is out with her grandson and they're just outside on this nice early spring day and meat starts falling from the sky. A lot of meat, chunks of meat, maybe 1 to 3 inches wide, about maybe like 100 square foot area, just meat falling onto the ground. And this is a thing that
I'm in heaven. I'm listening. Go ahead. Tell me there was like a whole sea of barbecue grills that were set up that afternoon. And this is going to be the greatest story I've ever heard.
Oh, well, right. Well, okay. So, so say what you want about some of this stuff. This definitely happened. There's no dispute that this happened. So the meat was gathered up by the towns, the townspeople who, you know, were trying to figure out what it was. Two very brave souls attempted to taste the meat to see if they could ID it through taste. And by both accounts, it was disgusting, and they both spat it out immediately. The New York Herald sends a reporter down, and he gets his hands on a sample of the meat. And so he's like, well, I want to see if I can pay somebody to taste this stuff. So he hires someone he describes as an Irish laborer. He says, look, I'll pay you money if you eat this meat. And the guy's like, all right, okay. So he puts this plate of sky meat down in front of this laborer guy. And the Irish guy, you're still with me, right?
I'm with you. You couldn't get rid of me now if you tried.
Yeah, right. So the Irish guy is like, takes one look at the meat. And he's like, you know what? I'm going to need something to wash this down. So the reporter's like, okay, you know, orders up some whiskey for the guy. He's like, you know, okay, there, you got something to wash it down. Let's do this. And, you know, the Irish guy is still kind of wary about it. And he says, you know, I normally, if I'm going to have a plate of meat, I'll have some sides, you know, some bread and vegetables to go with it. Kind of, you know, kind of make it a little kind of full meal. So the reporter's like, all right, okay. So he orders him some, you know, some sides to go with his Kentucky Sky meat. And, you know, and the Irish guy is still stalling for time. He's running out of excuses. And he finally just says, hey, it's Lent. I can't eat meat anyways. And he takes off and he refuses to eat this stuff. So now we've got this mystery meat that's fallen from the sky.
Give it to Mikey. Mikey will eat it. Mikey eats anything.
Exactly. Yeah, right. So this becomes an object of concern in scientific journals. And this stuff gets analyzed, and people are, you know, throwing out theories like maybe it's frog spawn, maybe it's you know, some sort of fungus, maybe it is they're throwing out different hypotheses. They don't really match up. They, you know, somebody IDs it under a microscope and says, and this is sort of a disturbing line. He says it's one of two things: it's either horse meat or it is from a human infant.
Well, that's kind of a big swing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like saying it's a Geo Metro or a Tesla. It's
right.
Definitely one of these two things. What?
Apparently, you know, human infant meat and horse meat look rather similar under a microscope, but who knows? So, but nobody can really ever figure out a plausible explanation. So the best explanation that we have right now is that it was a group of vultures who were group vomiting. That maybe they had all eaten a bad horse or something, and you know, they decided that, you know, they changed their mind about lunch, and they just decided to disgorge all in unison as they were flying over this woman's house. And that is the best we have, but it honestly, it's not great, because there was no report. I mean, you would think about the amount of vultures that would have to be in the sky to upchuck that amount of meat, and there were no reports of vultures. I mean, you would have heard them, you would have seen them, you know, a flock that big, you know, making all that noise, but there was no reports of any kind of vultures in the sky or anything like that. So again, I get to the end of the book, and I don't have a very good explanation for how this meat fell from the sky, but I did go on a hunt to track down the last remaining piece of meat from the Great Kentucky Meat Shower, which is in a jar in the Monroe Musnick Museum of Transylvania University in Lexington, Kentucky. And so that ended up being the kind of last bit of the book, was me desperately trying to find that last bit of sky meat and see if I could once and for all figure out what the heck it was. But yeah, that's one of many things that I ended up sort of chasing around in the book.
Wow.
Yeah.
So Tim, it's 1988 in college,
mm-hmm.
and mystery meat drops from the sky. I pick up a slab, throw it on the grill. Are you going to try it?
No.
Really? I knew you in 1988 at college, Tim.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure you would have eaten sky meat.
No.
Mm.
No.
Tim?
No.
Colin, don't. This is one of those conundrums we may never get an answer to either, Colin, that either one of us feel comfortable with.
Yeah.
But that is, yeah, it's just like a flock of vultures, not to be confused with a flock of seagulls, vomiting rancid horse meat.
I mean, Tim,
that's the best.
What about 2020? Would you eat it now?
No.
Tim, would you eat it on a boat? Would you eat it with a goat? Would you eat it here or there? Would you eat it anywhere, Tim?
There isn't enough emerald spices to make that thing want to go down my gullet.
Just you don't even need the spices. The meat's already gone. Bam! When it hit the ground, Tim. I'm just saying. It's ready. It's seasoned. It's softened.
Oh, grief.
It's either... I think the most disturbing part to me, Colin, is it's either baby meat or horse meat. Under a microscope, they're very similar.
Right.
How do we know that?
Tim, okay, so we serve it up for you. It's grilled to perfection, and then we say, I think this will be enough to make you think, you know, maybe you'd eat it. What if we said to you, we're pretty sure it's not baby meat?
We're pretty sure. Oh, in that case, Colin. Well, as long as it's not baby meat, well, now the wheels are turning.
We're like 75% sure it's not human baby that we're about to serve you. Is that okay? Would you eat it then?
Is it served in a nice sauce?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, sure.
It's McRib sauce, Tim, and you know we're going to get the emails telling us that I can already tell you listeners are sending us stories right now or their own theories that McRib meat is either baby or horse. And that's why they stop selling it. That's what's going
to... I have it on good authority. It's yoga mat. And yoga mats are delicious. Now, okay. Here's what does it for me. When I sit down to a fine culinary experience, there are different things that put me over the top. There is smell, texture, and taste, of course. Now... I can get over the texture thing. If the texture is a little rough, that's fine. I'm good. If the taste is, I can swallow it very quickly and get over it as long as it's not going to put me on the shelf for a few days. It's the smell. If it smells awful, I will regurgitate that in a heartbeat. Now,
how come you didn't mention delivery system? I've seen you eat chimichangas out of some guy's trunk when we're driving, Tim, but you won't eat mystery sky meat. I don't know. I don't think I know you anymore.
Well, I mean, you know, different strokes for different folks, and it depends on the situation. How rancid was it that the guy who had the whiskey and the sides decided, yeah, it's Lent, I got to go? I mean, it had to smell pretty bad.
Well, okay, so I can give you a little bit more information. Again, maybe this will help
And mind you, this is an Irish guy, so he's used to corned beef and cabbage. That smells horrible.
I love corned beef and cabbage.
So this happened on a farm, right? And so there were farm animals around when this meat fell from the sky. So the farm animals did partake of the meat as it fell. There were some pigs, apparently, a chicken, a cat, and a dog who all got a little taste of the forbidden fruit, as it were. And they all seemed to like it well, except for the dog who threw up later. So
okay,
if it's good enough for a pig, a chicken, and a cat, isn't it good enough for you?
The dog threw it up, though. I mean, come on. If a dog's throwing up,
do eat their own poop. So if it's throwing up the mystery sky meat, I might have just been won over by Tim's theory here. Yeah. And we can only hope that people listening to this are not eating their lunches or dinner while listening to this aspect of the show. Let's move on now, shall we? All right. So that's going to be a tough one to beat, Colin Dickey, as we wrap up today's show. But what's our final strange tale that you want to unfurl onto us before we say goodbye today? Just help clear the palate. If you will.
Oh man, I mean, it's really hard to top the Kentucky Great Kentucky Meat Shower. So, Let's see. I'm trying to think of what else really, you know, as Sinead O'Connor famously said, nothing compares to the Great Kentucky Meat Challenge.
Is that what that song was about?
It shortened it down to nothing compares to you just because the syllables were too long. Right. But the original draft was, you know, nothing compares to the Great Kentucky Meat Shower. I'm trying to think, so the other really fun thing I did was I went to Mount Shasta. Mount Shasta is believed by some to be the remnant of the lost continent of Lemuria. And the supposedly underneath the mountain is the lost city of Telos, where these Lemurians live. And I grew up in Northern California. I went to college in Oregon, so I spent a lot of times, you know, driving up and down I-5 past Mount Shasta. You know, you always see it. I don't know if you guys have ever been there, but you know, it's this beautiful, striking mountain that kind of rises up out of the middle of nowhere. But I never actually spent time in the town. And you show up in the town, and I kid you not, only place I've ever been in my life where there were the crystal shops outnumbered the bars by something like 5-1. I mean, it's just, you know, it was a really, you know, as one guy told me, you know, half the people in this town believe in this stuff and the other half want to kill that first half. One of my favorite interviews. So I'm just wandering around town. I'm just, you know, stopping in bars, just, you know, talking to whoever will talk to me. And I'm at this Mexican restaurant, and I just start talking to this guy. And he's basically like, at first he's real taciturn. He doesn't want to say anything about it. He's like, oh, I don't know, whatever, you know. And then, you know, second drink in, he's like, well, you know, I've seen some things up in the mountain. And he's telling me that he's come across like fences that, you know, modern fences that shouldn't be there. And, he, you know, maybe it's sort of government related. Maybe there's some sort of secret government stuff up there they don't want anybody to know about. But he's also seen, you know, Bigfoot a couple of times. And, you know, and he's seen some UFOs floating around the mountain. He looks at me dead eyes and says, you want to see some shit? Go up on the mountain, you'll see some shit. And, you know, that was one of the things that really struck me. And I remember, like, at one point he kind of holds his hand, kind of left hand up, kind of, you know, on the side. And he says, there's the stuff we know. And then he holds his other hand up kind of on the other side of his, and he says, and there's the stuff we don't know. And then there's everything in between. And that guy kind of was one of those kind of early voices that kind of informed the methodology of what I was trying to do. And I was like, yeah, you know, I'm interested in what's that stuff in between. And I'm also interested in seeing some shit. So that's, you know, that hopefully that comes across in the book. I mean, I had a lot of fun researching and going to these strange places. And I hope some of that, you know, comes across in the writing and for readers out there.
Well, you know, we're fine with writing a little blurb for your book. Hey, if you want to see some shit, and then, you know, Darkness Radio.
Great. Yeah. Absolutely.
The Unidentified Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained. It's available now. The link for that book is up on today's program. Colin, it's great catching up with you. I hope it's not another 3 years. How soon do you have your next book coming out?
Hopefully it won't be that long. Yeah, no, this was super fun. Hopefully I'll have more coming in the pipes. Just kind of waiting to see what shakes out of the tree. But yeah, with any luck, it won't be this long again before we get a chance to talk.
I've got to be honest with you though. You know, Colin, when I look at books to cover, I always love that, you know, they'll give us recommendations on Amazon of, if you like this book, you're going to love these two books. And I don't know what it says about you or your book, but just so you know, your book, The Unidentified, it says, is frequently bought with. The answer is Reflections on My Life by Alex Trebek.
Oh.
And Too Much and Never Enough, How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man by Mary Trump.
Oh.
So well, it's an interesting combination of books to go along with you. So it's the smorgasbord. It's kind of the mystery sky meet of America in book form. But we have a link up to Colin's book so that you can find it. And I'm going to also include a link to his other book, Ghostland, that we featured in the program as well in the past. So make sure that you look that up and get your copies. Colin, again, thank you so much for your time today. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh man, thank you so much. This was super fun. I was really glad we were able to do this. Thanks for having me on.
You got it. We'll be back on Tuesday with the best in true crime talk radio, True Crime Tuesday. If you haven't already subscribed, shame on you. Get on it. Subscribe to the show and listen to the best in true crime talk radio every Tuesday. You'll find information on how to subscribe at darknessradio.com. We'll be back again next week with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave. That's Tim. This is Darkness Radio.